From Vermont Public Radio, this is The Frequency. I'm Henry Ebb.
And I'm Anna Van Dyne. It's Thursday, April 30th. So Vermont announced its first case of COVID-19 on March 7th. That was 54 days ago, before this podcast even existed. And most of the time, we start this show by telling you how many new cases there are. But not today. That's because, for the first time in weeks, there weren't any new cases of COVID-19 reported in the state on Wednesday, and there also weren't any new deaths. This is a milestone in Vermont's response to the pandemic.
Since that first case back in early March, there have been 862 cases confirmed in Vermont, and 47 people have died. 11 people are currently hospitalized. But Governor Phil Scott says reopening the economy will inevitably lead to more cases. So to get ready for that, the health department says it's dramatically increasing its capacity for contact tracing. And that means identifying people who've been in contact with a patient who tested positive. The department says it could nearly double its 53-person staff and hopes to have the capacity to trace 900 cases a week if needed. That's a massive increase. Like we just said, Vermont has not even gotten to 900 cases in total.
The state also says it'll triple its current testing capacity. That means it will be able to conduct 1,000 tests a day over the next few weeks. And that testing and tracing ability is part of the reason the University of Vermont is planning to welcome students back to campus after the summer. UVM President Suresh Garamella said he was, quote, confident students will be able to return this fall with precautions in place.
Bars and restaurants have been limited to takeout and delivery in Vermont since March 17th. Some have closed, but many have adapted, bringing food and drinks out to customers' cars for pickups. So how's that working out? Well, for one perspective, I checked in with Jennifer Isabel. She owns El Toro, a Mexican restaurant in Morrisville. When I got on the phone with her, I asked her first how her business is different now compared to early March before the governor's shutdown order.
We're doing about 25% of what we normally do in terms of business for sales. And in the beginning, obviously, the restaurants were open, so customers were allowed to come inside and sit down and dine. And now they're no longer allowed to even come inside the door at all. They just drive up on the street and we bring the food up to them.
You originally started El Toro as a takeout business. Did that make it any easier for you to transition away from being an in-person restaurant to doing a curbside pickup model?
I think it did. You're right. When we first opened, we were only takeout. So this situation reminds me of what business was like when we first opened. We've always done takeout, even though we moved to a location where we had dine-in service. It hasn't been a hard transition to just do curbside because we've already been set up to do that.
Does it feel for you as a business owner, though, I mean, is it kind of a step backward to go back to what your model was a few years ago?
It's definitely different. I have 13 employees that I had to let all my employees go because there's not enough business to keep us all busy. And my first thought was that I would just do everything by myself. And after a week of that, I realized that I do need some help. I'm fortunate because I have four kids at home, teenagers, ages 15 to 21, who do work in the restaurant. So they're able to come in and help me for two-hour shifts where a regular employee probably wouldn't want to work a two-hour shift. But for my children, it works well because they can come in, work for 2 hours, and make a little extra money. Staying open has allowed me to at least pay my minimum expenses so I can pay my electric bill and my propane and insurance and phone bill. So we're sort of in a holding pattern where we're not necessarily making as much money as we were before, but we're able to cover our minimum expenses with a minimum staffing.
Does this feel, I mean, this model, you said it's covering your bills. Does it feel sustainable if it were to have to continue for weeks or months longer?
For me, it would be sustainable. I could continue to do this for as long as I needed to do it. The one thing that might not be sustainable is the level of rent. I'm paying rent on a 50-seat restaurant that no one is allowed to come into. That part would not be sustainable over, you know, a year. It would be sustainable over a couple months, probably. Mm-hmm. Hard to say.
Yeah. When you're thinking about a timeline of opening back up, do you have something in mind in terms of when you might be able to open your doors again, have customers sitting in the restaurant?
As soon as the state allows us to have customers come in and sit down and eat, then we will reopen. We're ready to do that at any time.
I understand you're not just a restaurant and bar, but you're also a sort of community gathering spot. You hosted musical acts and open mic nights before the shutdown. Mm-hmm. Would you go back to those things when you're allowed to let customers back in the restaurant?
I would, yes.
Do you have any trepidation about allowing, you know, people to pack into the space, even if you are allowed to reopen?
I feel that I wouldn't personally be at risk, or I could be personally at risk with catching a virus, but it's a risk that I'm willing to take personally. And I think customers who want to come in are sort of willingly taking that risk as well. You know, if customers are willing to come in and sit down and eat, I'm willing to open my doors and have that happen.
And just finally, you're sort of a family business, as you mentioned. A lot of your kids are working at the restaurant right now. What has that been like for your family? Are they happy to be working a couple hours a day, or is there any struggle there?
I mean, they're not happy that they have to stay home. Three of them are in school, and now all their classes are online, and so this gives them an outlet to get out of the house, do something different for a couple hours a day, and we have fun together.
Jennifer Isabel is the owner of El Toro Authentic Mexican Restaurant in Morrisville. Jennifer, thanks so much.
Thank you, Henry.
So here in Vermont, there are more than 300 incarcerated people who have passed their minimum sentences and could be released. Vermont prison officials often mention that they've reduced the state's prison population by 275 people in response to the coronavirus. But an analysis of the Department of Corrections policy and data suggests this number has more to do with fewer people coming in than more people getting out. And inmates and advocates say that's not enough. Here's reporter Emily Corwin.
Nearly 40 of Terry Parsons' fellow inmates at the Northwest Correctional Facility in Franklin County have tested positive for COVID-19. And Parsons says there's little he can do to protect himself.
It's very scary because this thing isn't targeting young people, old people. It's targeting everyone.
In 2016, the state convicted Parson of selling methamphetamine and conspiring to manufacture it. He was sentenced to 2 years minimum. Parson was 36 and living in Barton. Today, he's one of 350 inmates who could be released, either on parole or on furlough, two programs which allow inmates to finish their sentences in the community, so long as they abide by a strict set of rules.
I could be released at any time.
Parson is one of 65 inmates past their minimums and sentenced for nonviolent crimes. Many have told VPR they should be released because of COVID-19. As one person told me, risking exposure to a pandemic wasn't part of his plea deal. But Vermont DOC is only reviewing cases for inmates who are 65 or over and thus deemed vulnerable to COVID-19. Commissioner Jim Baker says these elderly inmates are being considered on a case-by-case basis.
But in some of those cases, the nature of the crime is pretty serious.
According to VPR's analysis, DOC has released two elderly inmates who were past their minimums since early March. 17 are currently behind bars. Baker says DOC is not doing any kind of pandemic-related review for inmates past their minimums who are under 65, people like Terry Parson. But he does say this.
There are circumstances right now where people are over their minimum, and some of that revolves around the lack of programming, and we are in the process right now of evaluating that.
Baker is talking about inmates like Terry Lizott. Lizott has severe asthma, which could cause complications with COVID-19. His minimum came and went last year. To get released, Lizott says he needs to complete a 9-month program designed to reduce his risk of reoffending. And that program has been suspended because of coronavirus.
So if they're not offering it, why punish us for something that's out of our reach and out of our control?
Now, Commissioner Baker says DOC is looking for ways for inmates to complete programming by video on tablets in their cells. Falco Schilling says that's not enough. Schilling is advocacy director for the ACLU of Vermont. Although Vermont has reduced its prison population by nearly 17% since early March, Schilling says it hasn't done enough to release inmates who are already incarcerated.
So one thing that we have seen is reductions in both the number of people coming into the system on the front end through law enforcement and from the courts, and the number of people being returned to prison from the Department of Corrections. That's where we've seen the majority of the reductions so far, stopping some of that inflow. But we also think there needs to be more done to look at the people who are currently incarcerated, who could be safely released, and that's really the next step.
Folco says many people are incarcerated right now because of furlough or parole violations, which likely would not lead to incarceration today. He thinks these folks should be released. Folks like Terry Parson. For VPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
Now a look at the Eye on the Sky forecast for today. Mostly cloudy and windy with a chance of showers. Highs ranging from the upper 40s to around 60.
Thanks for listening to The Frequency. If you're not already subscribed to this show, it takes just a second to do that in your podcast app, and you'll get a new episode in your feed every weekday morning. This episode featured reporting from Liam Elder Connors, Amy Kolbnoise, and Emily Corwin.
Our music is by Blue Dot Sessions, and our executive producer is Mark Davis. I'm Henry Ebb.
And I'm Anna Van Dyne. Talk to you tomorrow. I also found this old detective drama, like a radio drama. It's this like private eye who comes up from New York to investigate the ski accident in Stowe. Basically, the plot is like this woman was in this ski accident and then she was left paralyzed, and it was either her lover, her husband's lover, or her brother who was responsible for the accident. And then so like the private eye comes up and he's like talking to all the people and like stuff is happening. And one by one, all of the suspects get picked off. Somebody shoots them. And it actually turns out to be the woman herself who's not paralyzed. She was faking it.